So good evening. Last time we made it up through, I think we just started the section that begins with verse 40, establishing that even those who desire to attain mere liberation need to realize emptiness. So any questions on what we've covered so far? Again, at this sort of beginning part, if you will, because we're still not even really to the reasonings on emptiness yet, or the establishment of selflessness in the Prasangika Madhyamika school. But there still was a need on Shantideva's part to dispel a lot of the misconceptions that were out there, making sure that people understood the importance of realizing the perfection of wisdom. And so, you know, we went through the several sections that refuted some of the varying points of view, that other ways that selflessness was established, particularly in the Chittamatra point of view. And then just kind of spent a little bit more time kind of establishing that you know, there is a purpose, there's a necessity for realizing emptiness, and that it's effective, and that it actually does what it does. We're going to continue to work with this theme to some extent with this whole topic of, you know, that we need to realize emptiness even just to attain mere liberation. So again, as I mentioned last time, recall that all the lower schools say that there's a different realization that's what's needed, or the, I guess, minimal requirement, if you will, to be liberated from cyclic existence. And in the Mahayana schools of Chittamatra and Madhyamika Svatantrika, the autonomous middle way proponents, those two schools, they say that you do need an additional realization to become a Buddha. But in order to be liberated, all you need is the realization of this lack of a self-sufficient self. Self-sufficient in the sense of substantially existent. You know, so this is the idea that the lower schools propound based on teachings that the Buddha gave. In Prasangika, we're going to say this is a coarse realization of the lack of a self of persons. There is a subtler level, which is the lack of a truly existent person, which applies not just to person, but to all phenomena. So all phenomena and the person, you know, do not exist inherently, do not exist truly. And in order to even get just mere liberation, you have to realize the lack of inherent existence. You can realize it on the basis of a person, but you're going to realize it in the same way that it's realized on the basis of any phenomena. So we're going to get into the reasonings in a short while. Tonight we're going to continue with this whole section. So again, any questions from reading or from thinking about this, or any fortune cookies you've read or anything that maybe, you know, require commentary? All things are empty. Okay, so let's just briefly review this first part where the argument was put forward. This again is on page, the verses are on page 234, the two lines of, the first two lines of verse 40. So the idea here is that in the lower schools, particularly in the hearers' schools, which are again the Vaibhashika and Satrantika, the two Hinayana schools, they particularly are propounding that if it's simply by realizing these 16 attributes or aspects of the Four Noble Truths, one of which is the selflessness of the person, the lack of a substantially existent, self-sufficient person. And so this is how the Buddha taught it, and they believe that you can attain the result of foe destroyer. Again, foe destroyer simply means that one has destroyed the foe of the afflictions, the afflictive obscurations, which is all that keeps us bound in cyclic existence. The knowledge obscurations, on the other hand, are what keeps you from being a Buddha. And you need to remove the afflictive obscurations first, but these schools are saying that all that you need to remove the afflictive obscurations is the realization of these 16 attributes. And then we went on to look at this other commentary that Drukpa Gyaltsen gives that says there are also some additional things that the hearers' schools are saying that we take exception to. In the Prasangika Madhyamika point of view, these are a problem for us. They basically say there's no selflessness of phenomena in those schools. Again, we don't get into a selflessness of phenomena until we get to the Mahayana tenet systems. Chittamatra, the two middle way schools, they all adhere to some form of selflessness of persons, say that is, there is a misconception that's going on about all phenomena, not just the person. also the Mahayana sutra sets are not accepted as the words of the Buddha. This is going to play in some of what we look at tonight, where we use some of the Perfection of Wisdom sutras as a reason for why emptiness needs to be realized to attain liberation. And basically, they don't hold that the Mahayana sutra sets are acceptable as the words of the Buddha. So this is going to come into play a little bit tonight in what we look at. So why don't we go ahead then? We're getting into the response. The response is divided into three sections. The first one is, as you see from page 235, this outline is called Establishing that the Wisdom Realizing Emptiness is the Path that Liberates from Cyclic Existence. So middle way proponents come right out the gate and make their initial rebuttal to this point that the hearers have raised. So let's read that together, CD. It is because in the scriptures it is taught that without this path there is no enlightenment. So if we go to the commentary on the next page, 236, we see that this middle way proponent is then saying, it follows, they're putting forward kind of a reason, a statement, if you will, a thesis. It follows that the realization of the emptiness, or the realization of emptiness, you could get rid of the, I suppose, the realization of emptiness is definitely necessary even for the attainment of the results of hearer foe destroyer. So this is their thesis. So let's relate it to this up here, because we're going to talk about it shortly. So up on the board here, there's a thesis or a probandum. Probandum meaning that which is to be proved. So we have a subject, the subject here being the realization of emptiness. The predicate is definitely necessary even for the attainment of the result of hearer foe destroyer. So you could just replace that statement up there with that. And now Shantideva's going to, Drakpa Gyaltsen's going to give the reason. And it's, reiterating what Shantideva is saying in these two lines. Because in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, scriptures, it is taught that without cultivating this path that realizes emptiness, there's no attainment of the three enlightenments. Okay? So usually when we use these sort of, statements like this, just so you know, this is a way of helping people to attain a kind of realize that this is a correct sign so that they then understand the thesis and reverse their opposing view. So the hearer schools are holding an opposing view in terms of the probandum. We're telling them, no, you do have to realize emptiness. Realization of emptiness is needed to attain liberation. And you have to give them a reason then. If you just simply said that, if you were arguing with somebody and you just simply said, no, it isn't that way, well, then they would say, why? You would say, well, give me a reason why that's so. And the reason that we're giving them is kind of an interesting one, because it goes back to, like I said, to scripture. And we're going to get into this issue very shortly about, what if we don't hold that those are the words of the Buddha? Then, you're just not giving me anything that I can really work with. But let's leave that for now. What are the three enlightenments? When we say here it's necessary for the attainment of the three enlightenments. I'm sorry? Okay. Yeah. So sometimes we call these small enlightenment, middling enlightenment, and great enlightenment. Just so you know. So if you ever see those phrases, small, middling, and great enlightenment, this is in the context of calling all three of these an enlightenment. Usually in the Mahayana, we don't refer to the first two as enlightenment at all. We refer to them as liberation or the state of foe destroyer, but we won't say that they're enlightened beings. This phrase enlightened beings, or the aspiration to become enlightened for the sake of other sentient beings, doesn't mean these goals. It means the great enlightenment of Buddhahood. So let's continue with the commentary. It goes on to say, it is taught in the Mother Sutras. The Mother Sutras are the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. They're called the Mother because they give birth to all the Buddhas. Through the Perfection of Wisdom, Bodhisattvas realize, emptiness and go on to become Buddhas. Just as it has been cited in the great commentary to Shantideva's Engaging in the Deeds of a Bodhisattva, that there is no liberation for those having discrimination of things, meaning discrimination of things as being inherently existent. and the states of perfect complete Buddhas, and the states ranging from stream enterers to solitary realizers of all three times are attained in dependence on this very perfection of wisdom. Stream enterers is a term. How many of you are familiar with what stream enterers are? There's in the Hinayana paths, they usually set out four sort of results. Three of them are more intermediate, and the final result is foe destroyer. They begin with stream enterer, which occurs generally right after your direct realization of emptiness, your initial, the path of seeing, because there is a path of seeing for Hinayanas as well. They're just realizing it without all the accumulation of merit that the bodhisattva is doing. So stream enterer is where that begins. There's a once returner, a non-returner, and a foe destroyer. And to explain all of these in great detail would take at least a night, if not several nights. So we're going to let go of it until the course comes where we'll actually delve into that. But again, those are more intermediate results, and sometimes you don't even necessarily attain all of those results because they have to do with certain ways in which we're suppressing manifest afflictions through the developing various concentrations on the path. Again, if you need any more information on that, Jeffrey Hopkins is always a good source and has a whole section in there about how Hinayanas proceed in their path. It's towards the beginning of the book. I can point it out to you if you need to know. So all of these results are attained upon realizing emptiness. There's, you know, the Buddha has said in these sutras that you can't get anywhere without realizing emptiness. Even, you know, a Chittamatran who's very sincere in their bodhicitta, because Chittamatrans are Mahayanas, well, at least a bodhisattva, somebody following the bodhisattva path of Chittamatra, they're very sincere in wanting to become a Buddha, but unless they have the wisdom realizing emptiness, they can't even make it to the path of preparation, much less to the path of seeing, because they have to realize the correct view of emptiness to progress on the path. So all of these realizations are completely dependent upon the perfection of wisdom. Yes, Janice.
Why are the Hinayanas arguing that a direct realization of emptiness is not necessary for attaining liberation, even at their most rudimentary level of the stream enterer needs to have a direct realization of emptiness, which is the direct realization of the non-inherent existence of phenomena.
But again, that's coming from the Mahayana point of view. From the Madhyamika point of view in particular, that is required. The hearers are basically holding to their tenet systems, because we're talking here mostly about the hearer schools as opposed to hearer practitioners. This point is going to be brought up a little bit later as well. We can have Hinayanas in terms of tenet system, which would mean somebody following Vaibhashika or Satrantika, and Mahayanist in terms of tenet system, which means you're following Chittamatra or Madhyamika. Then we can have practitioners of Hinayana paths and Mahayana paths within each of those. So what we're talking about here primarily are the hearer's schools, not necessarily a hearer practitioner. And there may be hearer practitioners in the Mahayana schools that are realizing emptiness directly. We're mostly talking about the hearer schools here, and that's why, you know, in the previous section where we got that verse introduced, verse 40 CD, or AB, it said the hearer's school, as opposed to a hearer practitioner. So it's not to say, again, that there would be hearer practitioners who do adhere to this because they follow Vaibhashika or Satrantika tenets, but what they're adhering to is that according to the sutras that they hold as the word of the Buddha, which are the Four Noble Truths and, you know, that whole body of the Pali Canon and what have you, there isn't a teaching that they see that is a teaching of the lack of inherent existence. They only see teachings regarding the lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. So they're just simply saying, you know, we don't see that, even though you might have explained that this realization of emptiness is very efficient and gets the work done and what have you, we still don't think we need it for our goal. Because again, the hearer practitioners are only wanting to attain liberation. And when they're following hearer school tenets, then they're believing that all you need is this, you know, realization of a self-sufficient, substantially existent self, the lack of that. Yeah.
So So does that mean that practitioners that adhere to the Madhyamaka are the only ones who can attain at least the state of a stream?
According to the Madhyamaka, yeah. Prasangika, yeah.
That's so confusing to me. How could anyone in the Hero School at all even attain the first level if they don't even believe what the object needs to be?
Right. Well, and this is what they would hold, is that they basically are not realizing it. But it's not to say, and we're going to get into this again too tonight, I believe it's in this section, where there still is a level of the manifest afflictions that is suppressed when we realize that there is no self-sufficient, substantially existent self. Because Prasangika also says there is none. You know, they agree with that selflessness. They just say it's a coarse selflessness. It's not the subtle selflessness that we actually need to attain liberation or enlightenment.
It's what they talked about later in the chapter about the arhats.
Yeah, yeah.
Where they're not real arhats.
Exactly. Yeah. So what can happen, certainly, is that people can, even through developing some of these very profound levels of concentration, have some suppression of the afflictions. So there are, we're going to talk about this in a little bit. Let me kind of introduce the subject briefly, though. We can talk about kind of manifest afflictions and the seeds of those, if you will. They're very different things. You can get to the point through, again, practicing various types of meditation and also through some of these realizations that are coarser of suppressing a lot of your afflictions. In other words, they don't arise. Even with, you know, the regular stimuli of loud traffic and what have you, you never get agitated, you never get angry, you never get, you know, desirous, you never have those sorts of minds arising. Does that mean you've removed them, though? No, because again, to remove them from to have the seeds completely removed, you have to realize emptiness directly. So they might be, again, dealing with some feeling that they've gotten rid of these afflictions, not understanding that the seeds are still there, because the afflictions aren't manifesting anymore for them. So it's a bit deceptive. Okay. Does that kind of answer your question in terms of how they could...
I was trying to figure out where those practitioners were.
Yeah.
That were actually attaining those states. If they believe this, how could they?
Yeah. And, you know, what happens at some level is, I think, even though we can say that the realization of emptiness is much subtler than this realization of the lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent self, it begins to move practitioners in that direction, you know. And so there may be an inclination based on getting particular teachings or examining even the Hira Sutras, which, according to the Mahayana, even some of the Hira Sutras contain teachings that say that things don't inherently exist. It's just how you read them. You know, there's the one of, you know, form is like a bubble, feelings are like foam, you know, all these things. It's like there's five different aggregates are described in terms of five different phenomena. And according to the Mahayana, they can read this and say it's meaning that they have no inherent existence. According to the Hinayana, they can see it as simply saying that there's a lack of permanence in these things or whatever. It depends on how you read them. But, yeah, Rowena.
In the sense that, okay, the hearers have four levels of food, did they go for Heart Sutra?
No. The first wheel turning is all that they adhere to as the words of the Buddha, and they dismiss the second and third. The second is the perfection of wisdom teachings. The third is the called the wheel of fine discrimination. It includes the teachings on the three natures, other aspects of Chittamatram point of view, as well as more teachings on Buddha nature and what have you. I mean, and so again, the Mahayana schools hold that all three are the words of the Buddha. They just say, both of them say the first one is provisional, and then they debate about the other two. Madhyamaka holding that the second wheel turning is in definitive, and generally definitive, though again Svatantrika says there's some parts of it that need to be interpreted, and then Chittamatra adhering to the third wheel turning as being definitive. Okay.
No, they weren't termless, though. I mean,
they weren't
they
what?
They weren't hidden teachings.
No. Well, they weren't put down in, you know, written scripture until much later. You know, there is a time lag between what's come to be known as the Hinayana canon and the Mahayana canon of sutras. You know, so. But according to the Mahayanists, that doesn't prove that they weren't the words of the Buddha, because again, they adhered to. Because, you know, even the words of the Buddha that the Hinayanists hold were the words of the Buddha, weren't put down in scripture, written scripture, until long after the Buddha passed as well. You know, so that shouldn't be a disqualifying thing, as, you know, the distance between the life of the Buddha and when they were written down. Again, it just is how it happened historically, I assume, you know, to a great degree. Any other questions? These are good questions. Let's go ahead and read. I think that was the end of that bit of commentary for 940 CD. No, it isn't, actually. We got a little ways to go yet. Okay, so let's continue with the commentary. Again, this is on page 236. It says, furthermore, I didn't read this last bit. It said, it is not the meaning of the passage that only unsurpassable enlightenment is being referred to. So in other words, it's not just great enlightenment. It's all three enlightenments that the Buddha is speaking about in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras that require the realization of emptiness. Then it says, furthermore, not... I was outside, okay. It sounded like it was in here. Furthermore, not all of the countless passages from the class of sutra indicating that hearers have the realization of selflessness of phenomena have been cited. In other words, there's plenty more. It's not just this one. You know, the Buddha said it many, many times, many occasions, that this was needed. So these two lines of the text, 40 CD, state this probands having accepted that the Mahayana is established to be the words of the Buddha in the mental perspective of someone from the hearer school. So again, going back to this, the probands is the proof, the sign, the reason, you know, saying exactly why something can be established as so. So what this is just saying is that this whole, you know, two lines states this for the person who can accept this proof that these are actually the words of the Buddha, that the Perfection of Wisdoms, if the Buddha said it in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, well then that's good enough for me. I can use that scriptural authority to have a valid reason, a valid sign for believing the thesis, the probandum, that the realization of emptiness is needed to attain all three enlightenments. Now someone raises the qualm, well, what happens if they don't assert that the Mahayana scriptures are valid? Will it not be illogical to state that as the probands? In other words, you should come up with a different reason. Isn't it illogical then to have this as the probands? The response is that there's no fault. Because it is not necessary for the three modes of all stated probands to be established by the opponent right from the beginning. So now I need to give you a little sort of discourse, mini discourse, on the three modes. Has anyone heard of these before, the three modes, in debate, in a syllogism? Okay, so let's take a look at these and see kind of how they work. It's interesting when we kind of realize it, we see that they're kind of happening in our head already when we do this. This is just a way of talking about the logical processing that we go through to see whether something really holds water. So let's use this one that's up here. This is, you know, sound. The subject is impermanent, the predicate. Why? Because it is a product. This is the sign or the reason. The very first of the three modes is usually called property of the subject. What that means is this reason, because it is a product, has to be a property of the subject. In other words, if I said sound is impermanent because it is an object of eye consciousness, it wouldn't work, okay? An object of eye consciousness would be impermanent because all visual forms are impermanent, but it doesn't apply to the subject. Okay, so again, these are things that we do subliminally in our mind to check up whether something is true or not. But we don't really think about them in terms of actually identifying them. And these three modes get at then kind of what is all encompassed in making it into a valid syllogism, making it into something that actually has an appropriate sign that is applicable and works within the context of what your predicate is and all of this. So, Any questions on that first one? Second one is called the forward pervasion, not perversion, pervasion. Forward pervasion. So this is in regard to what we would call as a similar class of the predicate. So what this means in forward pervasion, pervasion means to, like the idea of pervading means you are totally kind of covering it and within it. So because it is a product means that this is then completely within the similar class of what your predicate is. In other words, if we say product, it is implicit that it is within this class of phenomena that are called impermanent. Not that it completely contains them. We're not talking about pervasion being meaning that everything that is a product is impermanent, everything that is impermanent is a product. That works in this case. But as I said, we could fill this in. The sound, the subject is impermanent because it is an object of our ear consciousness. It means that everything that is in this has to be in a similar class within this. So, objects of ear consciousness are all impermanent. All products are impermanent. We don't find a single product, something that is in here, that is outside of the similar class. They're all within a similar class. Again, we do this when somebody gives us the reason. You know, does that apply to what they were talking about? Yeah. Again, I can't come up with any sort of worldly examples.
Well, I was just thinking, what if you said you couldn't go shopping if you didn't have any money? If you didn't go shopping because your grandmother was sick, that might be, if your grandmother's in California, it doesn't matter. But if you have to take care of your grandmother, then, but see how it doesn't fit or it does fit.
Right, because there's no pervasion that because your grandmother's sick, you can't go shopping.
Yeah. Right.
We often use this phrase, no pervasion, meaning that, you know, you haven't really given me a reason that fits within this predicate.
Yeah, that happens all the time.
Now, what happens is that if somebody doesn't understand what you mean by product and doesn't really understand, you know, that products, by their nature, being produced by causes and conditions, are therefore impermanent, then it doesn't work for them. And they might say no pervasion, but then you have to work a way to get them to understand what product is so that then they see that it's in a similar class. They see that there is forward pervasion.
They're related in some way.
Mm-hmm.
They're interrelated in some way.
Interrelated, but to the point where there is nothing that is in this, that is pervaded, that is outside of this. See, what would happen if I said, Don is a man because he's an American?
It wouldn't make sense.
Because not all Americans are men. So all of the sign have to be pervaded within. There's got to be forward pervasion, or in a sense you could say all this pervades over everything in that. That's why it's usually called forward pervasion, is because you've got everything that's in the similar class has to be totally encompassing what's in this. Otherwise, your reason doesn't work. Your reason goes outside of it, you know. Like, you know, frogs are sentient beings because they are impermanent. Well, not everything that's impermanent is a sentient being, you know. So again, those don't work for us, and we can understand them very clearly because they don't have that forward pervasion. The other one necessarily follows that if you have forward pervasion, you have reverse pervasion. I think it's what we usually call it. Or counter. I'm sorry. In the text I have, it says counter pervasion. By the way, if you want to know more about these, there's a wonderful book by Daniel Perdue called Debate in Tibetan Buddhism. It's a big tome like this. And some real, you know, one of those insomniac nights that you have. You know,
just drop that on your opponent's foot and you can win the argument.
So what this means is that there's got to be nothing in this that is in a dissimilar class of that. So in other words, what is dissimilar to impermanent? Permanent. there can't be anything here that is permanent, because that's the dissimilar class of this reason. So all three of these relate to the reason. The reason has to be applicable to the subject. The reason has to be pervaded forward in a forward direction by the predicate. And the reason has to be outside of or counter to the dissimilar class of this. And again, we get it when it happens. Don is an American because he is an American man. Oh, no, that doesn't work. let's try it another way. Where there's something bigger in the... Again, the problem is that these two go hand in hand. So you're always going to have one if you have the other. It's going to be absent if you don't have one. So if we go back to Don is a man because he is an American, that's because there is something in this class, the American, that's in the dissimilar class. It's pervaded by the dissimilar class. So we have a problem because within the class of Americans, there are American women as well. Of course, there's also Russian men and what have you.
So what's the difference between mode 2 and mode 3?
These are really kind of getting at the same point, is what I'm...
From a different direction.
Yeah, exactly. And again, if we have one, we have the other in 2 and 3. You won't ever see a syllogism that works where 2 and 3... aren't both there. You get Purdue's book. I told you. Yeah, when you're tired of losing the debate, you just throw this at your opponent. And any questions on this? What we're talking about here? What if we said, somebody come up with one.
Oh.
I mean, in that way we can test it and see how it works with that. Okay.
There's no air conditioning necessarily, it's going to be hot.
In the winter?
It's hot in the summer.
In the summer because of no air conditioning.
Let's use one that's maybe not so... We have so many.
Yeah.
There is fire on the mountain pass because there is smoke. Is there pervasion on that? If we define fire as that which is hot and burning, I mean, not flames necessarily, but if there's smoke...
I can think of things with smoke, like just flames can actually put out.
But there's still fire there, is my point. Fire is that which is hot and burning, not that which has flames.
Yeah, but what the smoke without... Have you ever tried burning dung? It's quite howdy.
But that's got to be because there's still some fire in it. I mean, whether like in a coal, a charcoal or something, you still have some combustion going on. I would think, but anyway, let's maybe not get down to picking hairs on. So if we said that there is a fire on the mountain pass because there is smoke, or on the mountain pass there is fire because there is smoke. Then again, we have the property of the subject on the mountain pass. There's smoke, so there is smoke there. We can apply that. There is fire because fire is pervaded forwardly by there being fire, there is smoke. If there is, and then in reverse, there can't be smoke without there being fire or through something of a dissimilar class to fire. I don't know, this one maybe doesn't work as well. See if I can find another one in here that kind of...
I'm trying to think of one that doesn't use concrete examples. And I hesitate to say, like, people commit
how you would shift that back and forth with things that are concrete. So are you not?
You would still. You'd still do this. No, you'd still do the same thing if you say, okay, people, the subject, commit, let's use, ignorant or, you know, non-virtuous actions or whatever we wanted to say, you know, ignorant actions or actions, because they have not realized emptiness directly or something along those lines, or because they have not, maybe it would be better to say, because they...
But how would you then prove it backwards? Like,
well, the problem first is that we have to make sure we have a pretty airtight reason.
Yeah, and so that's too vague and too large.
Well, yeah, because wisdom can be a lot of different types of wisdom.
So I'm trying to find something that's not concrete, like fire on the mountain, and apply it to something in an everyday sense that's more philosophical. So that's what I was just ruminating.
Okay. I mean, I think you could still do it. I think you could still do it, but, you know, you could say people as a subject or sentient beings as a subject have afflictions. Why? Because they have not realized emptiness. You'd almost have to add more to it, because just the initial realization of emptiness doesn't completely remove all the afflictions either. So, yeah. This is a technique that we use in debate, and this is why, you know, syllogisms are used, is because then when you make a statement, your opponent just challenges that statement, and you have to come up with a reason, and then you find out that your reason maybe wasn't as well thought through as you like, you know, or as you would want it to be, because your opponent shoots holes in it. Well, you know, then it follows that, and this is where consequences come in. So if you were to say, okay, sentient beings as a subject, they have afflictions, and, you know, I'd say, well, you know, why do they have afflictions? You'd say, because they haven't realized emptiness directly. And I'd say, you know, the hearer on the path of meditation as a subject, it follows that he has no afflictions. And you would say, why? And I would say, because he has realized emptiness directly, because I'm using your reason to show you that that's the consequence of it. And yet the hearer on the path of meditation does have afflictions because he hasn't completely removed the afflictions.
So now it's more interesting to me when you apply it in
Okay. Yeah. This is the tool that actually from a very young age the monks are taught in debate technique, using the subjects that are in this book, what are called dura, collected topics, which are basically like categories of phenomena, mostly, you know, and various definitions and definiendums, you know, the various things that they debate to get their head around the whole concept of debating. But the debate is a forum in which to eventually get to really fine-tuning your understanding of all of this. Ideally, it would be great if we were all debating, you know, after every class, you know, for staying up all night for an all-night debate. You know.
Okay. If they realize emptiness directly, they have no afflictions still?
Well, there are some who do and some who don't. I mean, but you can't say.
Can you categorize what kind of afflictions and then make the syllogism work?
No, I think afflictions are afflictions. I mean, they include all afflictions, and any affliction. If the syllogism was sentient beings have afflictions because they have not realized emptiness directly, then we can make a consequence that the hearer on the path of meditation, they haven't become a foe destroyer yet. In other words, they haven't gotten rid of the afflictions, but they have directly realized emptiness, that they are without afflictions then. Why? Because they have realized emptiness directly, based on what reason was given. But again, we're showing the fault in that reason. And then once that person sees the fault, then they can adjust their reason accordingly. Then they can, you know, say, you know, sentient beings have afflictions. Why? Because they have not realized emptiness directly sufficiently to remove the afflictive obscurations or whatever. You know, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's to help people to get an understanding of all of this sort of, you know, more esoteric philosophical material. Okay. Does that help?
Thanks.
Kind of give... So again, all of these are kind of going on in your head when you are working with these things, but, you know, it's important to kind of understand that these three modes... It's interesting that they actually say that, you know, the way that Daniel Perdue says it, he says, the definition of a correct sign, meaning this proof or probands being correct, is that which is the three modes. Not which has the three modes, but which is the three modes. So it means it kind of is a property of the subject, is forwardly pervaded, is, you know, counter-pervaded. Okay? So, what is it being said in this explanation then in the commentary on 236 it was, is there's no fault because it's not necessary for the three modes of all stated probands to be established by the opponent right from the beginning. So which of these isn't established? Are all three not established? For the hearer, these hearers that don't believe that the Mahayana scriptures are the words of the Buddha, we've given them that reason. Here, the direct realization of emptiness is necessary because, to attain liberation, because it's in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Pardon? Yeah. Okay. So here, the pervasion of this probands, this reason, will also be established by genuine parallel reasoning below. So he's just basically saying that we will be getting into kind of how Shantideva goes on to establish that this is, you know, established through some reasoning, and that will be, you know, as we get into the reasonings of selflessness and what have you. Acharya Shantideva also posited the refutation of the wrong conception that refuses to accept that the Mahayana Sutra sets are the words of the Buddha, and then stated these following passages. The other commentary that I have, this Wisdom, Two Buddhist Commentaries, kind of explains that what Shantideva is, or what this commentary is saying here, is that Shantideva kind of brought up this whole issue of the Mahayana Sutras not being accepted in order to kind of open that debate, in order to kind of explain and establish why these are the words of the Buddha and why they are reliable. So that's really what this passage is meaning, what it's referring to, you know, in these following passages. He proved the probandum of this reason. Again, the probandum being realization of emptiness is needed to attain liberation. That the wisdom realizing emptiness is the paths of all three enlightenments, although the Mahayana is not established to be the words of the Buddha by means of establishing its pervasion, with respect to establishing it by scripture, that the Mahayana are the words of the Buddha, there is no misdeed in its application. So this is just kind of saying, you know, what this person was raising about, isn't it illogical to state that as the reason? No. There's no illogic, there's no problem with it. Why? Because Shantideva is going to go on to explain all of the reasoning that supports all of that, and it's a totally valid reason. There's nothing wrong with the reason. You know, certainly those people who don't adhere to the Mahayana as being the words of the Buddha need to be brought to that understanding, and that's exactly what Shantideva is going to try to do in this section. So again, this is why he's putting it out there, is to directly counter those people who hold that the Mahayana is not a sutra collection of the Buddha. Make sense? Okay. We still have one more little bit to this section on this first two lines of this section, and then we can get on to other verses. Somebody else objects, saying, the Mahayana sutra sets are not established to be the words of the Buddha for me, and I don't accept them to be valid. Hence, when establishing the path, proving that the realization of emptiness is also the path of the hearers through stating that, meaning that it's in the Mahayana Sutras, as the probands, is a case of the probands being identical to the probandum. What it means then is saying, you know, he's using the statement that realizing emptiness is necessary to attain enlightenment, all three enlightenments, because the sutras say realizing emptiness, I mean, in other words, you're basically using that to prove itself. And it's really for, again, somebody who's coming from that point of view of not adhering to it as being the words of the Buddha, not telling me anything that convinces me. Yeah. Okay? So now we get into this whole issue of how the sutras, the Mahayana sutras, are established as being the words of the Buddha in this little debate that ensues. So let's read all of verse 41. Well, actually, this is the first three lines. If the Mahayana is not established, how are your own scriptures established? Because they are established for both of us. So in this commentary, it just simply says hearer's school, but it's obvious that the hearer's school is responding to this statement. It says, if we're asked, how are your scriptures, these Hinayana Sutra sets that you assert to be valid, you know, that you don't have a problem with, why are these established to be the words of the Buddha? So if Mahayana asked them that, if Madhyamaka asked them that, then the hearers say that they are the words of the Buddha because these Hinayana Sutra sets are established to be the words of the Buddha for both of us. It's kind of like, well, you say they're the words of the Buddha too. If you say they are and we say they are, well, then there's no problem. Okay? So, middle way proponent. Let's read the last bit of 41 and then the first two lines of 42. Initially, they were not established for you. Your conviction in them, due to conditions, is also identical for the Mahayana. So on page 237, we see that the middle way proponent says, well, you know, you're saying that they're valid because we also say they're valid. Well, the reasons are identical because initially when you were just born and you haven't even determined them through, you know, studying them, looking at these scriptures, realizing their meaning and reasoning, all these Hinayana Sutra sets were also not established as valid for you. Okay? So it's not like we're born into this life thinking that these sutras are valid. You know? We check them up. You know, the Hinayanas, the hearers, looked at them, examined them, came to hold them as valid in the same way that we've come to hold the Mahayana as valid. That's what it's going to say here. You know, later, due to conditions for asserting the scriptures as valid, methods for determining them through scriptures, meaning and reasoning, methods such as teachings on the greatness of engagement in, these are the three pitakas, the three baskets of the Buddha's teachings, illuminating the Vinaya. Vinaya pertains to the higher training in morality. Engaging the sutra sets. The sutra sets are the sutra basket, which pertains to concentration, the higher training in concentration. And three, not contradicting the Abhidharma. Abhidharma is phenomenology. This is the basket of the teachings of the Buddha that pertain to wisdom. So these three higher trainings of morality, concentration, and wisdom, we can divide the Buddha's teachings into all of those. So once somebody sort of checked up all the Hinayana Sutras and said, you know, do they apply to these three categories of what we say are the Buddha's teachings, what they're all about, higher training and morality, concentration and wisdom, establishing them as such, then you develop the conviction in those as valid scriptures. So it was a process. It's not like you instantly saw them as valid the second that they appeared in your life, nor were they valid for you when you entered this life. You had to go through a process. So the probands that establish such is identical also for the Mahayana Sutra sets. In other words, the reason why they became valid is exactly the same why Mahayana Sutras become valid, because we do a similar process. We look at them, determine, you know, how they fit into the Buddha's teachings, and through analyzing them through scripture and reasoning and developing some understanding of their meaning, come to hold them as being valid. So there's no real difference. Otherwise, if something were true as valid due to being accepted by any two other persons, then it follows that the Vedas texts, you know, Vedas meaning the teachings of the Hindu traditions, the Vedic tradition, and the rest would also be true. So if you're only valid because someone else says that, you know, what you believe in is valid, is only valid because someone else says it's valid, well then, any two people who believe anything, then that's valid.
Right.
You know, so it's kind of interesting approach to some of these reasons. I don't know if they always kind of, you know, work, but if we go with them, I think they do point out some interesting things. Any questions so far? Let's take a little break, and when we come back, we'll continue on this. By the way, we are going to see this whole topic brought up again in verse 49, in terms of these three baskets and so on. Now, as far as the topic of debate, it certainly is good if you can, you know, one of the things that I was recommended to do from the beginning by Venerable Rabina, actually, was to partner up with somebody from the classes I was taking and engage in that kind of an interaction, even if it's just a discussion of things, you know. It really helps to solidify your learning. And that's what we ended up going to in the master's program, actually, was more discussion groups than debate. So we would have a small group of people that one person would kind of take leadership of it and ask people questions, and then people would challenge their answers in a more sociable way rather than, you know, all this kind of... So any other questions? Let's continue then. We were up to 40. Well, did we read 42 CD? I don't think we read it, but let's go ahead and read that and then read all of 43. If something were true due to being accepted by two others, then the Vedas and the rest would also be true. Because the Mahayana is disputable, because there is dispute with the Tirthakas regarding the scriptures and also between you and others regarding other scriptures, you should discard them. So, again, those last two lines had to do with what we read before. Again, if just two people agree to something, then if that's what makes it true, then there's a lot of things that are true out there. This next thing is somebody saying, well, this great exposition opponent, or it could be any of the lower school opponents, saying, well, but it's not just that, you know, we're agreeing with you that, or you agree with us that it's a valid set of scriptures. You know, the problem that we have with the Mahayana is that it's disputable. There's some sort of, you know, we have a problem with parts of it. Since the Mahayana Sutra sets, this is on page 237, since the Hinayana Sutra sets accepted by me are also accepted by you to be the words of the Buddha, there's no dispute. However, since I do not accept the Mahayana Sutra sets, then they are disputable. There's something, you know, that makes them, you know, not so easily accepted. They aren't valid simply because they're contested or disputed, because, you know, great exposition school and looking at them finds things that aren't consistent with their beliefs and therefore, you know, contests what's in them. Now, the middle way proponent gives that answer that we just read. One, well then, you know, this is kind of another consequence thing. Because there is dispute between the Tirthakas are the non-Buddhists who, you know, yeah, they basically have other beliefs that they would look at the hearer school and say that the Hinayana scriptures aren't valid. There's some dispute there. In other words, you can find somebody who would dispute with the hearers about the Hinayana sutras. And two, because although all 18 sub-schools of the great exposition school assert the Hinayana scriptures as valid regarding some other internal divisions of the scriptures, such as the teachings on the existence of the intermediate state existence, the bardo, since some in the hearer school accept them as words of the Buddha, while some do not accept them, then there's even dispute within the hearer school. So kind of looking and going, okay, well, you're using this whole issue of saying that we can disregard the Hinayana sutras because there's a dispute. Some of us don't agree. So let's just stick to what we all agree on. Well, the problem is that even what we agree on is disputed by people who are non-Buddhists. And even within what we agree on, the people who look at it find some parts of it that are disputable. And some parts that maybe they can't adhere to. If that's so, then there is also dispute within the hearers. I'm sorry, then it follows that you should discard even the Hinayana Sutra sets as being valid. So in other words, every reason that they come up with as to why they would not accept the Hinayana Sutras, Shantideva is just basically saying, well, you can't use it as a reason. Your reason isn't valid in the end, because we can use that same reason in another context, and it would lead us to throwing out the Hinayana Sutras. Everybody clear on that? Let's go on. Let's just read 44AB right now. While the root of the teachings is fully ordained monks, even those fully ordained monks themselves abide with difficulty. So what's kind of going on here is that the hearers, these hearers that we're debating with are great hearer school people, great exposition school. That's again the Vaibhashika is the great exposition school. They could say, you know, kind of contend that their scriptures were condensed by, it's used the term here, it's fully ordained monks, but we're not just talking about fully ordained monks, we're talking about fully ordained monks who are arhats, you know, who have attained the state of foe destroyer, who have an ability to very clearly know what the Buddha taught. Why? Because they've attained that state of foe destroyer. Okay? So if you've attained the state of arhatship, that means you've realized emptiness and realized emptiness enough to completely remove all the afflictive obstructions. So what they're going to basically contend in this section is, and we're going to try to answer to them, is if they say, well, the Hinayana Sutras are expounded or condensed from the words of the Buddha by people who have some understanding, not just, you know, any Joe on the street that, you know, happened to be around and wrote these words down. And, you know, so there is a way that we can look at this and kind of contend that these are the words of the Buddha, but it doesn't necessarily follow that the Mahayana come from that same sort of process. So let's look at the commentary again on 237. It says, the foe destroyers, having heard teachings from the Buddha directly, condensed them in scriptures which were subsequently taught. Thus, from among the many fully ordained monks explained, such as nominal fully ordained monks, the root of the teachings of the Buddha, Bhagawan, is the foe destroyer fully ordained monks. While that is so, even foe destroyer fully ordained monks themselves abide with difficulty. So what is Shantideva saying here? He's basically saying, okay, I'll agree with you that, you know, foe destroyer monks wrote, kind of were responsible for these, but we have an issue with whether they were possibly even really foe destroyers, because in order for them to be foe destroyers, if they really adhered to what they wrote, there would be some difficulty. Going back to Janice's point that she was raising earlier, you know, if you really are a foe destroyer, that means you really have realized the emptiness of true existence. There is no real foe destroyer that has not done that. So, I mean, we could again go back to our original thesis. The realization of emptiness is necessary to attain liberation or the state of foe destroyer. Why? Because the Buddha taught that that is so in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So, you know, relying on that, then we would also adhere that there are no fully liberated beings, foe destroyers, unless they've realized emptiness. Okay. So that's the idea that they abide with difficulty. In other words, it would be pretty difficult to posit one without the realization of emptiness being there. So here's a little sort of statement, another thesis being put forth by Madhyamaka. The subject, here superiors, it follows that they do not attain the state of foe destroyer. Why? Because they do not take the wisdom realizing emptiness is the path. Sounds like a little bit contradictory, because you almost want to put foe destroyer or hearer superiors in quotes here. Because would you even be a hearer superior? What is a superior again? How do we define a superior? Arya, okay, but what does that mean? Okay, so any being who has a direct realization of emptiness becomes an Arya, a superior. Means that they have seen the truth. So here superiors, in quotes, it follows that they don't attain the state of flow destroyer. Why? Because they don't take the wisdom realizing emptiness as the path. If we again go back and say that we're adhering to them as really being, you know, the ones who put forth all these Hinayana sutras that don't propound emptiness according to the lower schools, you know, because that's what they're relying on. They're saying that these Hinayana sutras don't teach emptiness of inherent existence. All they teach is the emptiness or lack of a self-sufficient substantially existent self. That's all that we need. And this was taught by foe destroyers, so it's got to be right. Well, Madhyamaka is having a problem with that. We've got our issues. let's go on with the commentary at the bottom of 237. So it says, this also indicates the flinging of the consequence that the state of foe destroyer is not possible for those who do not accept the emptiness, that is, the phenomena's emptiness of inherent existence. The term even in 944b, so if we go back to 944b, we see that it says, even those fully ordained monks themselves abide with difficulty. Even here signifies not only will they not attain Buddhahood if they are separated from the realization of emptiness, they will also not attain the mere state of foe destroyer. So it's kind of like, you know, just saying, you know, going back to our original thesis, everything still, you know, is being put forth by Madhyamaka that they absolutely have to realize emptiness in order to attain a state of foe destroyer. So there are no foe destroyers that haven't realized that, in spite of what they're holding around these foe destroyers who were the composers, if you will, the people who put together, condensed the teachings of the Buddha into these sutras and what have you. So any questions on that? Yeah, April.
But if they don't recognize the validity of those texts and don't see the definition of emptiness necessary,
though,
isn't their definition of a
book
different?
Well, but is it a real superior then?
I don't know, that's what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, we can say that the lower schools define superior, they define, foe destroyer, they define Buddha, all in terms of a different realization than what Prasangika Madhyamaka holds. But
how do you use that then as an argument that we're saying that they're not?
Well, what we're basically doing is kind of contending that yeah.
Circular again to me, using.
Well, and again, I think that there's going to be a certain amount of circularity to a lot of this, simply because we haven't gotten to the point, this has all been sort of proof by scripture, with scriptural authority, more than it has been proof through reasoning. You know? Yeah. Yeah. I guess, you know, to some extent, though, it's wanting to kind of deal with that issue up front, as opposed to putting out the whole reasoning of emptiness and not having dealt with it and dealing with it later. You know, there's some wanting to kind of get past it. But you're right, a lot of the reasons that they're putting forward still involve some prescribing to the Hinayana Sutras in some capacity. But the real, you know, scriptural authority, ideally, again, when we get into the different types of phenomena and the ways in which we realize things, only the most obscured phenomena do we have to depend upon scriptural authority for in the end. You know, like the intricacies of karma that we won't know until we're a Buddha, we simply have to rely on the teachings of the Buddha that propound that to some degree, and because we don't know, we really don't know, and we can't reason through it. I mean, something happens in your life, you can't sit there and meditate on, you know, the karma that caused that to happen. You can get a general idea, but you never know the exact action and so on. Whereas emptiness is a hidden phenomenon, but not thoroughly hidden. We can actually get to emptiness through reasoning, and we don't have to rely on scripture in the end. So again, we'll see this more as we get into the reasonings, but you're right, there is that circularity to some extent. On to 44CD. Those whose minds are together with observed objects abide in nirvana also with difficulty. So we look at the commentary and it says the subject, here are foe destroyers, again, labeled, merely labeled, even less than merely labeled, maybe fictitiously labeled. Here are foe destroyers. It follows that they abide in nirvana also with difficulty. Because before we were talking about here are superiors. So here we're going one step further and saying even those foe destroyers, those people who contend that they have completely gotten rid of the foe, of the afflictions, it follows they're abiding in their nirvana with difficulty. That is, even the nirvana of their continua is untenable because their minds are together with observed objects of the apprehension of true existence. So in other words, as long as they're still adhering to things as truly existent, there's no way that they can actually be in this state of foe destroyer. Foe destroyer is, again, it goes back to our original thesis. It's completely necessary to realize emptiness to attain that. But if we talked about other forms of selflessness rather than emptiness, I mean, when we say this, the lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent self, you can still, according to what Prasangika Madhyamika says, adhere to the person as truly existent while you're refuting its self-sufficient, substantial existence.
Yeah.
You know, so as long as we're observing objects without removing that conception, as it says here in the rest of the commentary, their minds are together with observed objects of the apprehension of true existence. That is, their minds adhere to things as truly existent without repudiating, negating the adhered objects of the apprehension of true existence. So again, this apprehension of true existence, we see, you know, pencil. There is a mere pencil that exists as a mere label, but we are adhering to it with this conception of inherent existence. So we are creating a referent object of that, if you will, a conceived object that holds it to be inherently existent. And we have to refute that, or else we can't get it.
I understand that, but if you watch how your attachment to a referent object undergoes all these modifications as you change the referent object, you then just start understanding how malleable you learn. Your own adherence to an object is in the first place. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. If you just watch, I mean, I have a great fondness for this book.
Right.
You know, well, I move this book, or I have a great fondness for this book. Well, those aren't even the same book. So what's hanging out there with the fondness in the first place is what I'm saying. I'm seeing this way of seeing the related emptiness of both. Same time, because if you change the referent object,
right,
you have a similar emotion. You can see that the emotion itself is not dependent on anything.
Right. And that's really a kind of, again, what this is getting at, is that they haven't even gotten to the point where they've realized that lack of inherent existence on any basis, so they can't really easily transfer it to any other object. They can't really, they're still together with that misconception. But what's interesting is in this section they're actually going to get to a point where they talk about the adherence to feelings as inherently existent, as being a part of the process, you know. So, you know, it's all phenomena are perceived as inherently existent, conceived as inherently existent, misconceived in that way, whether we talk about our feelings or the objects that we have those feelings about. And it's all a part of the process, yeah. Let's read all of verse 45. The afflictions are abandoned whereby they are freed. It follows that as soon as that happens, they become foe destroyers. Although lacking afflictions, the potencies of actions are seen in them. Okay. So the hearer's school, whether it's, again, over in the verse it says great exposition proponent, but here it says hearer's school in the commentary. But what they're saying is they're putting forward that the realization of emptiness is not necessary for the attainment of the state of foe destroyer. Instead, by cultivating the path that realizes the 16 attributes of the Four Noble Truths, such as impermanence, the afflictions are abandoned exhaustively, whereby they are freed and attain the result of foe destroyer. So this sounds like what we heard several verses ago. We're kind of like, well, you're back there again. But they're still going back to this idea that when we, according to their tenets, when they directly realize the truths, the Four Noble Truths and their 16 attributes, what that does is that acts as an antidote to the afflictions. The afflictions are abandoned, whereby one attains nirvana. So this is the process. You know, we remove what is the impurities in the mind, the afflictions and so on, and that causes this state of nirvana, complete cessation of all the afflictions, to manifest. Middle way proponent says, it follows that as soon as the manifest afflictions have been abandoned by persons who abandon merely the manifest afflictions for the time being, they become foe destroyers, because having exhausted the afflictions by cultivating the path of these 16 attributes of the Four Noble Truths, such as impermanence and so on, the state of foe destroyer is attained. So they're kind of saying that you're then positing that only some manifest abandoning of the manifest afflictions causes one to attain foe destroyer. What they're basically doing, this is what I was talking about earlier, is that we can talk about kind of different levels of the afflictions. What we call our manifest afflictions is the more active way in which these seeds are ripening into those emotions coming up. So we all have the seeds of anger and the seeds of attachment and the seeds of ignorance that are part of the cause for them to arise in present in the future. Through having done them in the past, we create those seeds. But we can engage in certain aspects of meditation, as I said, developing concentrations, but we can also even abandon some of these coarse misconceptions and greatly reduce, if not completely suppress, our manifest afflictions, the things that are manifesting. It's a noisy night out there. What's going on? I didn't know like driving down Alameda Street with your radio on was such a wonderful thing to do. I guess if I was young, I might. So basically in this argument, what we're going back and telling them then is that if you're saying that these are really foe destroyers and all they've realized is the 16 attributes of the Four Noble Truths, they haven't realized emptiness of inherent existence yet, then you're saying that just by abandoning the manifest afflictions, you become a foe destroyer. Does everybody follow that? Do I need to say it again? Maybe say it one more time. Okay. So what we're doing, Madhyamaka, and looking at the hearer's school, hearers are saying, these people who meditate on the Four Noble Truths and their attributes and realize that, become foe destroyers through abandoning the afflictions. Well, but we say it follows then that all you need do to become a foe destroyer is abandon the manifest afflictions, because according to our tenets, that's all you can abandon with the realization of the Four Noble Truths and their 16 attributes. So this coarser realization, it will suppress the manifest afflictions. You know, at some level, we won't be as angry if we don't think there's a substantially existent self-sufficient self. We won't be as desirous. We won't have any of these afflictions manifesting. But have we ripped them out by the roots and gotten rid of all the seeds? Absolutely not. So there is a bit of a, you know, again, that's why we would put these in quotes, here foe destroyer, here superior. They're not really a superior. They've realized something that is much too coarse to remove it from the roots and have only realized something that will suppress the manifest afflictions. So, continuing with this, the rest of that paragraph, it says, those two are taken to be similar in every way. I mean, those two points being that, you know, what we said and what you said then, you know, kind of comply. That's basically what you're saying, because according to what we are, you know, propounding. So now we're going to basically say the Madhyamaka point of view, which is saying basically that cannot be asserted. You know, what you would basically be holding then, that it's possible to become a foe destroyer by merely suppressing or abandoning the manifest afflictions, in no way can that be asserted. In other words, we were kind of giving them a consequence of what they're holding based on our point of view, and then saying, you know, and that can't possibly be true. You can't possibly be telling me that only abandoning the manifest afflictions, it makes you a foe destroyer. You have to abandon something deeper than that. You have to realize something deeper than that. Why? Because as it says here in this last bit of this paragraph, that cannot be asserted because, although lacking manifest afflictions temporarily, the potencies of actions that connect to future rebirths are seen in those persons who have abandoned merely the manifest afflictions. So in other words, I don't know who this is that's seeing these, but somebody is basically able to see that these beings go on to take rebirth again. They still have the seeds, the potencies of all of these actions and afflictions that will continue to keep them in cyclic existence. They can't possibly have attained nirvana. They can't possibly have attained foe destroyer. Because we see, you know, maybe again this is somebody in the next life sees somebody from the last life that they thought was a foe destroyer. I don't know. Got me who this is. Well, it's right. Yeah, and they're obviously, and the other side of it though too is to, I mean, they may have pretense, but they have realized something. I mean, we're not denying that this is a pretty major realization already, this lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. It's just, don't think it's more powerful than it is, and don't think it's subtler than, you know, it is. It's very coarse. It's a coarse realization. The subtle selflessness of persons or phenomena needs to be realized in order to actually have that state. So yeah, it is a bit of a pretense. I mean, this is again why we can't be so quick to judge other people's realizations or not, because we don't know, and maybe they don't even know. You know, somebody might have an earth-shattering experience that is the realization of a much coarser form of a lack of a self, and really have it change their life and their mind and how they do things, but it's quite temporary. It hasn't really removed the root problem.
That whole thing about how the garden will die kind of still sticks to me. There's so many folks that's kind of, you know, going around.
Yeah.
That's more scary.
Yeah. Is everyone familiar with that, how Nagarjuna died?
He was beheaded because in a very previous life, having those wings, he had influence for the work that he ran. Now, he cut off the head of an ant with a blade of grass or something like that. I mean, they have some really dire stories about them, you know, and somebody.
And it's always interesting whether we are to take some of these factually or as sort of a lesson for us to not be so, you know, grandiose in thinking that we've done more than what we've actually done. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a bit of that, yeah. Let's continue. This is more commentary on the same verse. The afflictions are abandoned, whereby they are freed. This is from the first line of verse 45. So this is again what the Great Exposition School is saying, or the Hearer School is saying. This expresses the system of the previous side, in accordance with the explanation that by seeing the truths, one will be freed, which we saw earlier in the beginning. Again, this is what I was telling you, is that this seems to be like they're raising the same point and still adhering to this view that, you know, they put it back in verse 40 in the very beginning, that all they need to do is realize the Four Noble Truths and their 16 attributes. It says, it is to be explained that when by cultivating the path of the 16 attributes of the Four Noble Truths, such as impermanence, afflictions are abandoned and freedom will be attained. So it's kind of like they're going back and explaining that in accord with what they said earlier. They're simply going on to explain that they believe that realizing it in this way causes the abandonment of the afflictions, which thereby causes the attainment of nirvana. Okay? In this context, this is an argument regarding whether or not freedom from the afflictions will be attained by way of merely the path of the 16 attributes of the Four Noble Truths. And this is very clear from the argument by seeing the truths and so on. So what is basically being said here, and we're going to get into in the next paragraph, this is not an argument as to whether or not liberation is attained by abandoning the afflictions, but how does one abandon the afflictions and thereby attain liberation? There's no question in the higher schools, lower schools, anywhere in the Buddhist schools, that you don't attain nirvana or foe-destroyer state without abandoning the afflictions. What we're debating is, how do you abandon the afflictions? Is it just the realization of these 16 attributes of the Four Noble Truths, or is it something else, which again, Madhyamaka would propound that it is? So it says here in this next paragraph, therefore, the explanation that, and this is a bunch of words in here, we'll try to get through it, having asserted that the path of the 16 attributes of the Four Noble Truths, such as impermanence, is able to exhaust afflictions, it is not that one will be freed from all suffering by it, is utterly not its meaning. So in other words, we're not contesting that, you know, if you abandon the afflictions, you won't be freed. Hence, if it is posited that one attains the freedom that is the exhaustion of afflictions by the path at the time of temporary absence of manifest fluctuation of that posited as afflictions common to the two hearers' school due to having generated in one's continuum the path as explained earlier, then the following assertion must be refuted. So what they're saying, as I said, it's a lot of words, is that if you're saying then, we're not debating about whether if you abandon the afflictions you become liberated. We're debating about your saying that if you just realize these 16 attributes, then you've abandoned the afflictions. When you've only temporarily abandoned them so that they are not manifesting at the time being, then therefore you've abandoned them. That's going to be a problem for us. So we have to refute this assertion. The assertion is given in quotes there, due to merely the manifest afflictions having been abandoned temporarily, as soon as that happens, the freedom that is the exhaustion of all contaminations will be attained. Because Madhyamaka is looking at what they're saying and once again going back and reasserting that if you adhere to this, then you're telling me that only the temporary abandonment of the afflictions will bring you complete liberation. Can't accept it. This cannot be asserted because, although lacking afflictions, the potencies of actions are seen in them. So this reason that's given in 45 CD indicates that, although they are lacking these temporarily, they have the potency to project future rebirths by the force of actions. And that this is actually seen, you know, that somebody sees this. Again, don't ask me who that somebody is. It's not really explained in our text or in the commentary to any degree. There's there are some passages that are quoted by Gyaltsep Rinpoche in this thing that kind of point to some similar examples that I guess are the way in which they're seen. Again, I don't know. I'm assuming that he's getting these out of sutras. Again, I don't know what the exact source of these sorts of quotes are, but let's read through this and see. We can talk a little bit about these beings that are mentioned in here. So it says, these passages must be explained in this manner. It should not be taken as asserted by some commentaries and Tibetans. on account of seeing the issuing forth of suffering, the result of actions that were accumulated at the time of being ordinary beings previously in Madgalyayana, Arya Angulamala, and so forth, that they did not become freed immediately. We're not talking about, in other words, this potency that gives rise to some form of suffering in that life. I guess we could point to Nagarjuna as another example. What we're talking about, they might, you know, abandon to some extent these manifest afflictions and not experience these forms of suffering that are pointed out in these stories of Madgalyayana. Madgalyayana, he basically had, he had, I think, like beaten his mother or something when he was young. Yeah, he beat his mother. And later in his life, even though he was contended to be a foe destroyer, it said that he, you know, was beaten by, you know, his disciples or something, or some, you know, by the Buddha's disciples. And then this other guy, Arya Angulamala, his name actually means rosary of fingers. He killed 999 people and formed a rosary from a finger from each of them. And I guess he got to he was supposed to kill 1,000, and he couldn't find the 1,000th one to kill. And he was going to kill his mother, I think. And an old man came by just before he was going to kill his mother, and he decided, oh, I'll kill this old man instead. And the old man, you know, kind of appeared to be walking away from him slowly, but he was unable to catch up to him, and he kept calling out to wait. And the old man replied, I am always waiting for you. And so it was the Buddha appearing to him, and so that's why he, you know. But anyway, I guess he had something else that happened later in his life that had to do with, you know, the same sort of idea of experiencing some form of suffering later, even though you are a foe destroyer. So that's not what Gyaltsep Jay is saying, basically, that's not what we're talking about here, that type of potency that would give rise to some form of suffering. Because we might still even see that in very holy beings. For example, I mean, in the life of the Buddha himself, who attained not just foe destroyership but Buddhahood, you know, was seen to step on a thorn, you know, later in his life, or have Devadatta try to kill him and what have you. You know, there were all sorts of things that would appear to be suffering, and we're not necessarily talking about those in this context. What we're talking about, this is not the potency which will generate suffering of this life. Rather, it indicates that since the ability to project future rebirths due to karmic actions has not been overcome, therefore they're not freed. So again, there really aren't examples that directly speak to somebody who sees these beings having the potency still to experience rebirth and then going on to experience rebirth in spite of having attained foe destroyer through these realizations of the Four Noble Truths and what have you. But this is what we would hold in the Mahayana, is that they still have that. They haven't removed these potencies for rebirth. So we're going to stop there, but we'll see when we go forward into the next verses. They say, well, but you've removed some of the things that act as causes for those seeds to ripen into a rebirth. Those of you who aren't familiar with the teachings on the 12 links of dependent arising, you might refresh your memory on those. We're going to touch on those in the next time we get together, because that's a part of this process. It's not just the karmic seeds, but they have to be ripened through the force of craving and so on. And this is a point that the lower schools are going to make, is that, well, we've gotten rid of one of the main causes that causes us to take rebirth. But again, we still hold that they haven't gotten rid of the seeds. We're going to be doing 46 when we come in. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, we'll go 46 through the end of this, 51. If you can prepare even the next section up through 56, I think that's about as far as we're going to get. Because this gets into a whole explanation in here. Well, even if we get into the next few verses after that, we're going to do a little bit of talking about the views of the self in this school before we get into the actual refutation. The actual refutation, or the reasoning that proves selflessness or emptiness, starts with verse 57, so we're getting close to it. I may make a sort of a I don't want it to be a unilateral decision, but there's a whole section on refuting the acquired view of a self, which entails like looking deeper at the Samkhyas and the Vaisheshikas, and this is a more complicated section that we haven't really studied these non-Buddhist schools, and I'm thinking that it might be better to really gloss over them and not go through them verse by verse, because I have the feeling it's going to take us a real long time, and I'd rather stick to the things that are maybe a little more... I mean, I know that I don't want to say that what Shanti David said wasn't relevant, but maybe, yeah, but relatively relevant. Yeah. Maybe what I'll do is, I'll definitely read them through, and you know, kind of maybe do a condensed thing through them where we won't go through verse by verse, but we'll talk about kind of the main points that are being contended and by these other non-Buddhist schools and what's being, how they're being refuted. So we won't necessarily go through, because otherwise I'm afraid that I don't want to necessarily again forego the study of this just out of time constraints, but I'm also worried that it's going to get a little bogged down. So if that's okay. And again, you certainly are welcome in His Holiness's book to read the sections pertaining to that. It starts with basically verse 60 and goes on through about 70, I think 70 or 71. 69, I'm sorry. We will resume with verse 70 after that, but... Okay. Any questions? Okay. Let's do our prayers. And sorry for, it's 9:15. I really was hoping to end a little bit earlier, but let's just go to verse to page 246, to these verses from Shanti Deva's text. And again, as we recite these for all sentient beings, we might bring to mind specific individuals who we're dedicating this merit for. And you don't need to necessarily announce their name, but to think of them as being here and kind of receiving the blessings of the merit that we've created tonight, that it becomes the cause for the removal of their suffering in this life, their suffering in psychic existence, that it becomes the cause for their complete enlightenment. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food, thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments, whatever diseases there are in the world. May they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Back one page on 244, recite these two prayers in English for His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Lama Zopa. Maybe we can go ahead and insert between them this prayer in English, prayer that spontaneously fulfills all wishes. So again, think that we're creating the causes not just for the good health and long life of these very two precious holy beings, but also for the good health and long lives of all teachers with whom we have a special karmic connection, so that we might never be separated from them nor from the precious Mahayana Dharma that they teach in this lifetime and all lifetimes until we attain the state of Buddhahood. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrese Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Savior of the snowland teachings and transmigratory beings, who makes extremely clear the path that is unification of emptiness and compassion, to the lotus holder Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjuna's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And lastly, we can think that the merit we've created here tonight, and that we ourselves can become a cause for peace, peace in the hearts and minds of all beings throughout all realms. Okay, thank you all very much. Thank you, Master Shantideva.